This cassette colloquium consists of material from a seminar on programming for industrial process computers held during the 1970 IEEE International Convention and Exhibition in New York City. The material included was selected by Mr. Eric A. Weiss, seminar advisor, and represents a summary of the subject. This colloquium provides an introduction to the problems of programming digital computers for online, real-time control of industrial processes. After an initial definition of the principal terms and a statement of the functions required of process control computers and languages, successive speakers elaborate and extend the theme. They deal with the unique characteristics of process control programming, the nature of the available programming languages, and the special requirements of process control. The colloquium ends with a summary of the field and a statement of the visible trends, followed by the responses to questions from the seminar participants. The seminar director was Dr. Thomas M. Stout, president of Profimatics Incorporated, an engineering and consulting firm specializing in computer applications in the process industries. Dr. Stout.
Good morning. This is the educational seminar on programming for industrial process computers. Our first speaker this morning is John Hiestand from Profimatics. John is a chemical engineer with a bachelor's degree from Lehigh and a doctorate from the University of Michigan. He spent 3 years with West Virginia Pulp and Paper Company. In 1964, he joined the Bunker Rainbow Corporation, where he was instrumental in the installation of a process control computer on a paper machine. Later went with the General Electric Company and is currently with Profimatics. John?
Thank you. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what a process control computer is and what it does. First, let us define a few terms. Process is an assembly of equipment performing physical and chemical transformations on raw materials to convert them into more useful or valuable products in one of the following ways. Continuous process are such processes such as chemical and petroleum processes, steel, paper making, glass, and many others. Might also include in the continuous process electrical power generation from such sources as coal, oil, gas, or nuclear fuels. Batch processes are those processes which are usually used for small quantities of specialty chemicals such as pharmaceuticals. Batch processes also are used in some industries where they were the predecessor of the continuous process and investments in capital investments in large quantities of equipment would be required to convert these over to a continuous process, such as in paper pulp making. The semi-batch process is a combination of the continuous and the batch process, and generally is used in those cases also where process equipment cannot be converted without large capital costs. We might also include in process the discrete processing. The processing of products, manufactured products such as automobiles and appliances and others of this type. Usually, process control computers are not applied for the same reasons to discrete processes as they are for continuous or batch processes. But the techniques and the system functions and requirements are quite similar. Therefore, we would include these in the process discussion. Process control computers are also applied to various other applications for data collection and control, such as laboratory data collection on chromatographs, mass spectrometers, and other types of equipment such as those. For product testing and adjustment online, for mail sorting, poll registration, TV switching, and many other applications of this type. Again, the reasons for application to these particular, in these particular types of applications are not the same as for those in the continuous and batch operations. But the techniques and functions and requirements are somewhat, sometimes quite similar. What do we mean by control? Control can mean many different things. Basically, it means meeting specific operating objectives in the process. These operating objectives can be classified under many separate subheadings. One, and probably the main one for the application or the justification for the application to continuous or batch processing is a maximum earnings from the process. But while applying computers to obtain these maximum earnings, other objectives must also be met. One could not take the lowest cost raw materials and convert it to the highest priced finished product and continue to operate from day to day on this basis. Production schedules have to be met. As product demands change, the schedules change, and also the requirements on the process change. Specified product qualities must be met. A particular product, for instance, a certain weight of paper, could have many different product qualities, and there may be many different grades of this certain weight of paper. And for a given customer, these quality specifications have to be met. And this is all done within the maximum, under the maximum earnings from the process. In addition, we would like to control the minimum use of raw materials and utilities. Many processes, the raw material costs are the largest single factor in process costs. So if we can minimize these or save a small percentage of the raw material costs, we can increase the earnings from the process. In addition, we want to minimize the use of utilities. We also want to avoid hazardous conditions in operating the process. We want to protect our equipment, our plant, and our people. In many processes, particularly continuous processes, the equipment can be damaged by a runaway of the process. So we want to monitor and act on the process when a runaway becomes apparent. In today's increased stress on pollution, there's an increased thought about meeting laws and regulations. The laws and regulations on pollution have become more important to manufacturing people. What is a process control computer then? How is it used? The computer is an assembly of hardware which has logical, arithmetic, and memory capability. In a process control computer, in the sessions that are following, we're going to be talking about stored program computers as opposed to strictly hardwired logic. These computers are used for control. They are interfaced with the process and take control action directly on the process. Why do we need a process control computer? A process control computer is needed because we can't run from day to day on the same product, on the same raw materials. Orders change. Customer requirements change. Product qualities, product quantities, all change. And in this change, it is necessary for us to be able to adjust our process to float with this change. The prices change. Product price change, raw material prices change. So the optimum point in operating the process is going to move. And therefore, we have to change processing conditions in order to optimize our profit from the process. Raw materials change. Particular source of raw materials may run out, and we have to go to a lower grade raw material. In this case, we may have to change operating conditions in order to use this lower grade raw material, or to use it to our optimum profit advantage. The equipment characteristics change. Heat exchangers foul, catalysts degrade during the operation, and process changes, operating changes have to be made to compensate for these equipment characteristics. The process conditions change. By this I mean those conditions which are not under control. The ambient conditions, the temperature of the air, the humidity of the air, have various effects on the process. And the process, those process parameters that are under control need to be changed in order to compensate for these ambient conditions. What functions do the process control computers provide? One of the major functions they provide is computing the present status of the process. Where are we operating now? How do all the process parameters fit together and make up a process operating status? In addition to this, then, how can we move this status to gain a higher potential, either production or a higher potential profit from the operation of the process? This is done by optimization. Optimization would probably be done with a process model, which takes the present status and runs the model through various steps using any of a great number of optimization techniques to determine the maximum profit or the optimum operating point of the process. Then the third function that the computer has to perform is to actually regulate the process. Once we've optimized it, then we have to manipulate the process parameters, the process variables, in order to move the process to the point we want. And this is called regulation. In addition, regulation also includes holding the process at the operating point that we've determined from our optimization. Once we've got it there, we have to keep it there. And this is another function of regulation. Regulation also is used is for strict control, for the replacement of analog control equipment, or the addition of loops which are difficult to control by analog control. One of the bases for justifying a process control computer is reducing the variability of the product quality, also reducing the variability of the production rate. And these are done by better regulation. Process control computers can do a better job of regulation on those functions where transport delays are long or there are complex interaction between process control variables. In these cases, it's possible to regulate the process to reduce the product quality variation so that we can move the average product quality toward its lower limit, thus reducing the product quality giveaway. And in turn, we can also increase production, getting maximum production from our process. What are the requirements of a process control computer? There are three major process control requirements. Process input output. These are in the form of analog inputs, measurements of variables on the process in the analog form, and converting these to the digital form, which can be handled by the process control computer. In addition, there are digital measurements taken from the process. These are in the form of contact inputs or outputs, pump motor switches, process alarm, digital type process alarm sensors, valve open or valve closed switches, and this type of thing. In addition, there is a special type digital input that is used in process control computers. This is the interrupt. This is a digital input which interrupts the computer at the task in which it is performing and takes action immediately. The process also, in addition to the inputs, must take the digitally formed variables from the analog inputs, operate on those, and then in turn make some control action on the process. And this is usually done by converting then the internal digital form of the output to an analog output and operating a valve. Or it could be opening and closing switches which turn on pumps, motors, and open and close valves. In addition to the process inputs and outputs, there are the operator inputs and outputs. These, in many cases, are very important inputs and outputs and are generally in the form of consoles. Now, consoles include forms of the of several other types of inputs and outputs, such as push buttons, dials, audiovisual alarms, lights, horns, buzzers, etc., and alphanumeric displays, which may be in the form of Dixie tubes or CRTs. The operator has to communicate with the computer to let the computer know some of the decisions that he has to make, particularly what grade of product he wants to make, what his product specifications are, and he has to be able to tell the computer what these things are. He does this with these push buttons and dials. He also requests from the computer various types of information. These are generally displayed in alphanumeric displays or on typewriters. The operator may also have a typewriter-type keyboard with which he communicates with the computer. These typewriter-type keyboards are not probably the best types of operator input devices because operators generally would have difficulty with this type of keyboard. Therefore, it would be recommended that the operator console would contain more of the types of devices that he's used to using on his control board, such as the push buttons and the dials. In addition, the computer would drive trend recorders. And these recorders, when driven by a computer, have the ability not only to record those variables that are measured by the computer, but also computed variables. And the operator could select, in this case, the computed variables or the measured variables or any combination thereof. So the process computer has to have the ability to drive these things. One of the other requirements on process control computers is programmer input-output. These would be in the form of tape or card reader and a punch, and a typewriter output or printer, line printer, and some sort of a keyboard, either typewriter or other kind. The programmer has to be able to interface himself in a somewhat lower level or computer level to the computer than the operator. The operator should not be able to get into programs and make changes, but the programmer has to be able to do this. One other type of input-output that process control computers, particularly of the medium and large scale, have are bulk memory input-output. These are in the form of magnetic drums, magnetic disks, and magnetic tapes. These are used for storing up programs that are shared in the core memory Storing of programs that are used to do background calculations, storing of data that may be used for offline simulation or offline analysis, or any other type of data collection. I think that concludes my discussion for this morning. Thank you very much.
The next speaker is Sterling E. Weaver, a leading expert in the field of process control computer programming. Now with IBM. Mr. Weaver.
Good morning. The title of this presentation, Process Computer Programming, Unique Characteristics and Language Implications, is extremely general and provides a wide latitude of subjects in which to be very specific. I think it first appropriate to be more precise in defining the term process before we get further into the presentation. The term process control came into being between 10 and 15 years ago and is highly indicative of the original applications involved, primarily in the area of continuous processes, petroleum, petrochemical, cement, and paper, to name just a few. Therefore, process control implies, to me at least, more of the continuous process type of applications. However, in recent years, the term process control must also include a wide variety of newer applications, primarily in the area of manufacturing industries, specifically those which involve discrete processes as opposed to continuous processes. The trends we see today point out that the discrete process type of application is moving ahead at a very rapid pace. Some of these applications involve production monitoring, quality control, circuit testing, direct numerical control of machine tools, high-speed data acquisition, hybrid applications, and jet engine testing. One common requirement of most of these applications that we see becoming more prevalent is that of response time. In the production monitoring and quality control area, we find applications which require on-the-fly analysis and control of quality measurements. Circuit testing applications have demanded that response measurements can be contained within the microsecond timeframes. Direct numerical control requires response in order to cut metal at a smooth and consistent rate. In the high-speed data acquisition area, if we cannot respond to data as it appears, the application cannot be met. In the hybrid area, response might involve the actual control of cockpit instruments in a flight simulation, where the turnaround time, responding to the measurements of the activities in the cockpit, and computing the next values to be placed into the instruments on the instrument panel, involve a very precise response time. Today, I think it appropriate that we define the common buzzword, response time. I remember many years ago installing control computers which only required a response time to the nearest minute. In that application, each minute certain activities had to take place, measurement of input values from the process, and computations to adjust the output values to control the process to a more precise point. As time has marched on, however, these processes have generally tended to become more involved. Our measurements have also become more precise, and our methods of optimizing from a mathematical standpoint have become more sophisticated and have also demanded more in terms of response time. Prior to actually defining response time, the remainder of the presentation will focus in on not only response time, but also the reentrant problem, which is one of contention for a specific resource from a variety of sources, which will be discussed with a general theme in mind of response and how it relates to the contention problem. If time permits, we will move into a discussion of error handling techniques, and also a somewhat controversial subject of language implications and how they all relate to response time. There seems to be a paradox developing. The applications are moving into more response-critical areas, and yet high-level languages are also becoming a much more definitive requirement. In the past, we have often found that the application of general-purpose compilers in the area of process control has not necessarily produced the optimum in terms of response. So later in the presentation, we will touch on this area and point out the pros and cons of the different approaches of languages and how they relate to specific applications and the response time issue. We will now delve into some of the more intricate components that are involved in the term response time. It is easy to get into the trap of defining response as the number of instructions that the system must execute in order to get into the application program. As you will soon see, this is really not a precise measurement of the term response time. From the point of time that the event occurs, or an interrupt occurs, many different things might happen within the computer system until the point where productive application code is entered. We will define the first time segment, T sub 1, as hardware lockout. Within this first time segment, several things can be happening within the hardware. In systems where a priority interrupt is a hardware feature, the exact level that the system is executing on can become a significant factor in how the response will be made to the event. If the event is tied to the highest priority hardware level in the system, then priority does not become a factor in impeding the response time of the system. However, if the event is responded to on a lower level of priority, then the degradation in response will be dependent upon the activities involved on higher priorities in the system. If we are extremely concerned about response time and wish the highest response for this particular event, we would place it at the highest priority of the hardware interrupt level structure. And this would rule out priority as a factor in degrading response time. Another element involved in the first time segment, T sub 1, is one of instruction length. As you are probably aware, instructions in a given central processing unit generally have a different length of execution time. Some instructions require only one memory reference, while other instructions require multiple memory references. In some central processing units, one instruction can execute for many milliseconds, depending on, for example, the number of words involved in moving data from one place to another. During the instruction, the central processing unit cannot be interrupted in most architectures. So under worst-case conditions, one must take into consideration the possibility of the event occurring at the very beginning of the longest instruction execution. The third area under the first time segment T sub 1 hardware lockout is that of masking. This is also sometimes called the inhibiting of interrupts. The system or the application program might be in the process of masking the entire interrupt structure in order to accomplish a particular event at the time the high priority event requires servicing. So one must understand the length of time that masking can occur not only in the system, but also by the application program. We will look at this area later as we discuss the reentrant coding problem. The second segment of time, T sub 2, we will call hardware status save. At the occurrence of an interrupt, the system must remember where to go back to after it accomplishes a necessary task. One of the more important pieces of information that must be remembered by the hardware is the instruction counter pointing out where in the memory the CPU should continue executing after the interruption. In some systems, the hardware saves not only the instruction counter, but also accumulator, status, and the index registers. So one must be very much aware of the amount of time that is consumed within the hardware to perform this automatic savings of status in the machine. Third segment of time, T sub 3, we will call software overhead in. Where T sub 2, the hardware status save, leaves off, the software must pick up and must save remaining pieces of status of the hardware, set up the machine for reentrant coding, record specific pieces of information for error diagnostics, and determine if the task required to service the event is in core or on a secondary storage unit such as a disk or a drum. This is a highly variable area, and one must pretty well understand the method of operation of the particular software, often referred to as the executive or the operating system. Another important consideration during time segment T sub 3, the software overhead in, is that of cycle steal, sometimes referred to as direct memory access. What this means is that certain asynchronous input-output operations are actually stealing instruction cycles from the machine to present data to the machine or to take data out of the machine in order to provide overlapped high-speed input-output operations. This implies that one must understand not only which I/O devices can be active, but also their accompanying data rates. At this point in time, we have entered the user's application code where the productive work actually begins. As a general rule, programs which are highly response critical and are tied to high levels of priority generally execute quite rapidly in order to retain a responsive mode of operation. Simple tasks are often performed, such as incrementing counters, measuring elapsed times, and recording the value in storage, comparing data to a previous value, data smoothing, and various limit checking operations. As the priority of the program lowers, we generally find longer executing tasks, such as optimizations, the printing of reports, and even the compiling of programs. So far, the only thing we have really done is to get into user code, but we have left out two other very important time segments involved in the total subject called response time. What happens when you exit your application code back into the system? We will define the next time segment, T sub 4, as software overhead out. This segment is pretty much the inverse of time segment T sub 3, the software overhead in. If registers must be restored by software, this is the point at which we must restore the system registers back to the point they were originally operating at before the event or interrupt occurred. Other bookkeeping may be necessary depending on the hardware and software architecture involved in the particular CPU. Again, during this time segment, the cycle stealing interference of different devices, not only process input-output devices, but also data processing input-output devices, can certainly have its effect and must be understood in order to measure the worst-case response time. The final time segment, T sub 5, we will describe as hardware status restore. This again is the inverse of time segment T sub 2, hardware status save, that we discussed earlier. This is where the hardware will take you back to the point at which you were interrupted. Therefore, the total response time, or in other words, the unproductive overhead necessary to accomplish the application code or the user task, is defined as the sum of the five time segments, T sub 1 through T sub 5. The reason for this is that if an event occurred just at the end of the execution of the user code, or the application code, it would be necessary to exit through the software overhead out, the hardware status restore, and the initial time segment T sub 1 called hardware lockout, T sub 2 hardware status save, and T sub 3 the software overhead in order to get back to the same user code necessary to accomplish the task. This is why we must understand the total response time component or overhead necessary in the system. This is one of those unique characteristics of process computer programming that should be understood by the programmer of a response-critical application. Sources for interrupt might include responding to a high-pressure condition, an abnormal temperature, the touch of a human finger on a console button, or the fact that real-time data will be made available in the next X number of microseconds and must be sensed. The next area for discussion this morning will be another buzzword entitled reentrant coding. The real problem here centers around the word contention. In process control systems, where priorities are a rather common occurrence, there tends to be many different events trying to capture the identical resource. Obviously, a single task executing in a serial manner is exempt from this problem. The very simplest of examples of the contention problem is to have two different tasks operating asynchronously, vying for the use of the same subroutine. An example of this might be a floating point subroutine. The problem is, how is a subroutine capable of being interrupted and reused by a higher priority program? We will discuss several different methods for solving the problem, and each method will be discussed as it relates to the general problem of response time. Most subroutines tend to create temporary or intermediate data necessary to produce the final results. This data is generally stored into the primary memory or core locations and reused or regenerated into final information. The problem is one that involves a higher priority program calling the identical subroutine while it is in the middle of its operation or halfway through producing the final result. If the subroutine is re-entered on a higher level, all of the temporary data stored in the main memory will be overlaid with new results, and the program using that subroutine previously will be unable to execute properly. Now we will discuss several methods of solving this dilemma, which is very prevalent in process control environments. The first method is a most straightforward method and involves keeping all the intermediate or temporary data produced by the subroutine in the machine or hardware registers, either the accumulator extension, or various other registers in the machine. If this technique is employed, the interrupt will cause machine status to be saved and restored. Therefore, we do not really have a problem of contention, since all the intermediate data and temporary data will be restored back to the original condition for the interrupted program to execute successfully. The problem with this method is that the subroutine cannot generate more temporary data than can be kept in the number of registers in the particular machine architecture involved. This means that the subroutine is usually rather short and not too complicated. The second and fairly common method of handling the contention problem is one of inhibiting or masking of interrupts. We will show shortly where masking of interrupts can significantly delay response time, as we discussed earlier in the general handling of interrupts. Subroutines, therefore, which employ the masking technique should be very short routines, so as not to degrade the required critical response time of the application. Another way of describing this technique is that through the technique of masking, an entire subroutine would effectively operate as though it were one hardware instruction. A third technique to handle the contention problem is one of actually allowing the subroutine to be re-entered and reused through higher priority activities. We will call this the work-level storage technique. This is more applicable to larger subroutines where a large amount or a considerable amount of temporary data is generated and cannot be kept in the machine registers. The fact that this technique is employed with longer routines points out the need for the ability to again be response sensitive, since we cannot mask a long executing subroutine at will and still maintain the type of response we really need for the application. One method of implementation is to set up one of the index registers to point to a unique work area or work level area for each interrupt level that the system requires. A subroutine will then be coded such that all instructions for storing temporary data will reference that index register and thus automatically be storing data into the appropriate work area corresponding to the interrupt level that the system is executing on. Another method of avoiding the reentrant problem can be called one of elevation. This generally requires a special hardware feature called programmed interrupt. This permits a subroutine to execute on a specified interrupt level. With this method, all programs requiring this resource from a contention standpoint will execute at levels lower than the subroutine is elevated to. Thus, the resource or the subroutine will be serially reusable by all programs requiring its use. The benefit of elevation is one of permitting higher-level interrupts to occur which do not require the resource. This is one benefit over the masking technique, which essentially can inhibit all interrupts from entering the system. The fifth method is one of queuing the use of the resource. This is commonly used for subroutines which cause input-output operations to occur, since an I/O device cannot be handled simultaneously by many different users. In this method, there must be one program or monitoring routine which accepts the request to use the resource and then queues up the request in either a first-in, first-out or a priority sequencing method of handling the resource in a serial manner. These five methods of handling contention may not be all the methods that can be employed to solve the problem, but are perhaps the most popular involved in current process control applications. Probably the most obvious method of handling the contention problem is one of avoiding it altogether. This generally can be handled where no more than a single application is involved in a computer at one time, and activities do not occur on an asynchronous basis. In relating the contention or reentrant problem to that of response time, we find that the work-level storage technique, or keeping data in the hardware registers, generally will have a benefit over the masking technique in terms of responding to the event at an earlier point in time. However, this also involves the aspect of how long the subroutine is which must execute. In some cases, the masking technique will not materially negate the effect of response time. The point of this discussion is that when programming for a response-critical application, one must understand the reentrant techniques employed by the system in order to understand the potential response problems which might be encountered. The next major area of discussion today will be that of error handling. This is perhaps the most difficult area to design, not only from a system standpoint, but also from a user standpoint, in as much as, what do I do when an error occurs? The basic concept we will discuss is one of error passback. There is no way in which one can generalize an error recovery action for a particular error condition when considering a wide spectrum of process control type applications. Each application area may require a different action as a result of the same error occurring. The most notable example of this is a power failure occurring during the actual control of a process. Most control computers have a power failure interrupt capability. Once the interrupt occurs, there is generally a very short window of time in which to accomplish the desired result, which is usually in the very few milliseconds range. There is no way for a particular system to generalize the error recovery action. This is purely an application-dictated action. In one case, it might mean initiating an audible alarm. In another case, it might mean freezing of set point stations in order to avoid the runaway of control actions. And yet, in another application, it might mean the program cannot function since high-speed data can no longer come into the system. Drastic measures of this sort could possibly employ the use of a duplex or backup system. Examples of other errors occurring in a process control environment are device parity, which could either be a process input-output device or data processing input-output devices, device failures, the fact that the program queue has reached an overflow situation, or an unchecked program has failed. With many of these different error conditions being passed back to the application program, a decision must be made as to the appropriate action for each error condition, again stressing the importance of the application determining the correct response to the error condition. In some cases, it may be necessary to retry the identical program with a different set of data, or in other cases, to ignore the error or abort a program. It may be necessary to retry an I/O device to see if parity can be eliminated, or to reload the entire system in attempting a warm start in a case of rather severe failures. We will again relate this subject back to the first topic of response time. It is important to understand the performance parameters of each recovery action available in the system. Reloading the entire system off a bulk storage device can certainly take longer than restarting a particular program or retrying an I/O device or even aborting a program. Ignoring an error certainly doesn't take much time at all. I will now give an example of error passback taken from the IBM 1800 MPX operating system. A call statement to an I/O control routine requests an I/O operation to start up. The main parameter of the I/O routine points to an I/O list. At the end of the I/O operation, a particular word in the list is filled with an integer error parameter indicating whether or not an error occurred, and if so, what the error was. The statement after the call to the I/O routine can then perform a computed go-to statement in Fortran based on the parameter in the list. In this manner, control can be transferred to the appropriate error handling routine necessary to recover from the error condition based on the particular application involved. The final area of coverage today will be that of language implications. I will not draw any specific conclusions as to the best language to employ for process control, but I do intend to relate the various language approaches to performance and response considerations, as well as application characteristics and the economics of using a particular language. In terms of application characteristics, one must consider whether the application is more oriented towards the conversational use of a terminal, whether a more procedural orientation is required in order to specify various sequences of operations, or whether the application is in a somewhat static environment where programming changes are not required at a very rapid rate. In terms of performance requirements, we must understand the implementation techniques employed in the various language approaches in order to determine whether a specific language will in fact do the job. There is a basic trap that is often fallen into, that of stating that my computer system is only busy half of the time. The overall utilization of the CPU is not always the determining factor in being responsive. It happens to be the combination of events that can all happen at a particular time, which is much more important than the overall utilization of the machine over a long period of time. Some of the economic considerations necessary to understand are the availability of competent programmers, the cost necessary to justify a large enough computer system required to handle a high-level language, and the estimated amount of installation time, which can also be a function of the language level itself. These factors must be traded off among each other in order to determine the optimum solution for deciding on a language. The basic assembler, obviously, is the most primitive. Other languages involve macro assemblers, compilers such as Fortran, Algol, etc. VL1 certainly could be a contender, depending on the future market acceptance. A fairly recent technique, fill-in-the-blanks, has been employed in many process control applications. Special-purpose languages are also becoming more popular, and certainly the conversational type of language has its place in the very generic land of process control. Let's now take a look at each of these language approaches and discuss some of the pros and cons of each approach. The basic assembler is certainly applicable for small memory machines where tight control must be exercised over the performance of the system. Some of the drawbacks involve requirements for a very competent programmer, the difficulty of debugging the application, and the requirement of a thorough knowledge of the hardware and the software of the system. This can be both good and bad depending on your individual outlook. The macro assembler, on the other hand, has not only been around a long time, but is also quite underrated in terms of its applicability to the process control area. The macro assembler generally requires a bulk storage device on the system and permits a very tight control over performance in response-critical applications. One of the other obvious benefits of the macro assembler is that it will permit a high-level type of language to be employed in a special-purpose application area. This language can be easily tailored to an individual application. This approach will require at least one good systems programmer to specify the language and the code that is generated through the macro expansions. However, the programmers who employ the use of the macros need not understand the basic machine level of the system. They can merely program via a set of macros or a language which adequately describes the application. I will now give some examples of macros which are oriented to the batch sequence control area. Many of these operations involve the opening and closing of valves. I can therefore write a macro called open and close, and in the operand field describe the valve number. I may also want to write a macro which says wait a prescribed number of seconds while the flow is moving. In an automatic warehouse application, I may want to write a macro called move. The parameters of the move macro might be to move a particular vehicle number to a particular aisle in the warehouse, to a particular row, and also to a particular bin number in a three-dimensional coordinate system. In a circuit testing area, a macro might be to stimulate a circuit and to designate the circuit number as a parameter. Also, I might want to delay a certain number of microseconds in order to wait for a response back from the stimulation of the previous circuit. Thus, the macro would be wait. The nomenclature used in these sequential type operations can be applied to the macro names, and thus a special language can be created. A general purpose compiler such as Fortran certainly does have some benefits in terms of the broad usage of the language today. It is generally not as good for small memory computers and usually requires a bulk storage device on the system such as a drum or a disk. In order to remain within the standard language and perform process control operations, the call statement can be employed, which permits the calling of subroutines where the actual inputting and outputting of process data occurs. This data can then be handled in a normal fashion through Fortran arrays and computational procedures. There are three main areas of trade-offs involved in the design of a compiler such as Fortran: that of producing efficient executing code, that of producing code which consumes a small amount of space, and that of compiling a program in a minimum amount of time. It is not always possible to accomplish all three goals at the same time. One area nearly always affects the outcome of one of the other areas. Based on Fortran's wide market acceptance, I foresee its continued use in a process control environment for some period of time to come, even though the language itself may not be aesthetically oriented towards a process control environment. Fill in the blanks is another category of language. It is primarily a specification type of language rather than a procedural language. This means that there is no procedural aspect of programming to learn in order to employ this technique. In fact, no programming skill is required at all to implement a fill-in-the-blanks type of system. It does, however, require very specific skills in terms of the application in order to fill the forms out properly. The major benefit of a system of this type is that a quick installation can be accomplished without the use of skilled programmers. These systems generally require fairly large computing systems, but this can often be traded off against the economics of quick installation time and the lack of programming expertise. Fill-in-the-blanks tends to be more suited toward applications in the continuous process area, such as petroleum, petrochemical, the paper industry, and it has also been applied to some applications in the discrete process area as well. Because the discrete type of process applications have a wide variance of performance requirements, one must be very much aware of the ability of a fill-in-the-blank type of system to meet the performance requirements demanded by some of these applications. Some of the more specific types of data which are required for fill-in-the-blank data forms involve the variable identification, the engineering units required, the processing interval, the conversion equation, coefficients, the high-low limits in various categories, and information about controller set points, just to name a few. Another major class of languages involves a special-purpose language. A special-purpose language implies that a particular application requires a particular language. This can be implemented through the special design of a particular compiler to handle a special-purpose language. This can easily amount to a 10 to 20-man-year effort. A special-purpose language can also be implemented by a macro-assembler technique, which is not perhaps as high-level a language as might be desired, but nonetheless will offer a measure of a special-purpose language. Another technique which has been implemented is a metacompiler, sometimes known as a compiler-compiler or a metaprocessor. In this technique, a language can be specified as input to a general language processor, which produces specified output code. This technique can result in a very long compile time, but can produce a very high-level approach to the problem. This technique also requires a very competent systems programmer to specify the syntax of the language itself, along with the resulting semantics or output code generation resulting from the syntax. The final language area that I would like to cover today very briefly is that of the conversational language. This involves APL, BASIC, PL1, and Fortran, plus a myriad of other conversational languages. A conversational language generally implies the use of a terminal or a keyboard printer in dealing with the system. Application areas which require this type of language are often found in the research laboratories and universities. As an example, in a research laboratory, a scientist might demand through a terminal that a particular instrument initiate a data acquisition cycle so he can look at the results of the data acquired from the instrument and determine the best analytical approach to handle the data. Due to our very brief period of time this morning, we have not been able to dwell on any specifics within each language application area, but I hope that we have tried to point out some of the general characteristics involved. In summary, I cannot stand here and provide you with any general prescription as to which type of language facility you should use. You must start with your application, determine first of all the economics involved and the performance required, and then you can more appropriately select the proper language mechanism to make your application work. We have tried today to be a little more precise in defining what process control encompasses. We've also noted the trend of higher performance requirements becoming more evident in recent process control type applications. We have also noted the continuing requirement for higher level languages. Yet we have tried also to point out the precise definition of what response time really means in your application and how this relates to the problems of contention involving reentrant coding, the handling of errors, and the implications of selecting a language. I hope this has been very helpful to you today. Thank you very much for the chance to speak.
This is the end of Side A. To continue the program, turn your cartridge over and play Side B.